It's May the 4th, insert Star Wars joke here, and just like we've had all four seasons today, the breadth of topics up for discussion on Radio 1 was impressive. Here's a taster of what's coming up on Playback Daily with me, Gemma Craddock.
What age am I? I'll be 81, please God, in May.
Mona, how are you feeling now that you can have 4 visits a week from family and friends?
I'm really delighted.
There is a sort of an onus in us then to see that those institutions begin to reflect the diversity of our society, just as they also need to reflect diversity around gender and other issues also. I mean, if our institutions don't look like who we are, they're not going to do a great job on our behalf, I think.
I don't think we suddenly have sort of manifested an epidemic of children who grow up sexually attacking each other. I think porn is causing it.
A lot of the landscape there is untouched. Like, you can see, looking at those mountains, that neither a cow nor a plough has touched that land in millennia.
The real beauty in learning any language is you have to immerse yourself with the people, and there is a Seanáil, Mahastianuch, Atniach, Orin, Warren, Argenta. If you want to get to know us, live with us.
Let's start with something upbeat, shall we? And Nursing Homes Ireland has said that today is a very special day for nursing homes and their residents, as changes to regulations mean that visitors can now make 4 visits a week with a maximum of 2 people per visit. And for a dose of pure happiness, let's listen to these residents of the Glendunna Nursing Home in Middleton, County Cork.
Delighted. Yeah, delighted.
And what have you missed about not having visits?
Not seeing my wife, and not seeing my dog, and not seeing any of my family, actually.
Yeah.
I got 2 children. They're both in their early 50s. I haven't seen them for over 12 months. No, more than 12 months.
Yeah, so what are you looking forward to most?
They're having a good family get-together.
Mona Crean from Glasheen Park, and I'm what age am I? I'll be 81, please God, in May.
Mona, how are you feeling now that you can have 4 visits a week from family and friends?
I'm really delighted.
And what did you miss most about not having visits?
Oh, not seeing my family and hearing all the news. I think it's great, and I think hopefully things will be back to normal soon.
I'm John, and I'm 73, and I'm from Cork, but from Dublin before that.
And can you explain how you feel now from not having any visits to now being allowed 4 visits?
I'd like to be able to get out a bit more, but we'll be able to know the lockdown coming to an end. I'd like to go to the house and have a bit of a feast with somebody who come with me. Anne would come with me. We'd buy something in the supermarket and have a bit of a feast in the house. No? I'd like to go. I don't want to visit at all. I'd like to go someplace. No? If the visit comes, I'd like to sit in their car and they go and go someplace.
Yeah.
Coming in to visit me, I'll be bothered with that.
That was Patrick, Mona and John of Glendunna Nursing Home, as heard on the News at 1. And Brian also spoke to Siobhan Grant, manager of St Joseph's Nursing Home in Shankill in Dublin.
Absolutely wonderful that we have now an increase in all the people that are coming to visit us here. Up until now, over the last few weeks, we've had 2 people a week, 2 visits a week. So every resident was entitled to have 2 visits, but that was only 1 person. So last week we had maybe 2 people coming to visit someone. This week they can have the possibility of having 8 people. It's quadrupled the number of visits for us to come in. So this morning, just we've had. Grandchildren welcomed back, so they mightn't have seen their grandparents for 15 or 16 months, and it was just so lovely to see people coming in. The atmosphere, yes, it was busy. Yes, there's a lot more people in our visiting area. We manage this whole visiting process so rigidly, and we wouldn't be able to do it without our wonderful meet and greet volunteers that we have. We've extended the volunteer roles that we have at St. Joseph's include meet and greet volunteers, and without them we would not be able to welcome all these families and friends back to St. Joseph's.
And we know just how important social contact is for all of us, but particularly somebody in a residential care setting, and to have been cut off from family and friends for so long does take a toll, doesn't it?
Absolutely it does. St. Joseph's, Brian, I don't know whether you know, everyone who lives here is living with dementia. So we would be the largest home that solely looks after people with dementia. So for many of them, you know, they might know that someone's missing, but our staff here over the last year have really kind of stepped into that family role. We care for people in a household model of care, so the love that people need to feel like they matter and like they feel they're needed, our staff have delivered that. Mm-hmm. But of course, the families have missed, on the outside, have missed their mother and or their fathers or their brothers and sisters, uncles, aunts. And because of that distance, you know, they can often see the decline in mm-hmm. people's health.
There are other services, Siobhan, you offer in normal times, respite and yeah. daycare services. They remain closed, though. How soon might you hope that they could resume again?
Well, I suppose, Brian, today gives us a real chink of hope. You know, when we saw the plans maybe 10 days ago about, you know, how many people can come in, it gives us hope for those people that come to daycare normally here. And normally we would have two people every week who would stay with us for a week for respite. Mm-hmm. That has not been in place for since the 16th of March last year. For those people struggling at home, which I know I speak probably, you know, on their behalf, they have struggled through the year. They've cocooned on their own, trying to, you know, manage their husband or wife. And the lack of social interaction has really affected them, probably more than the people who live here at St. Joseph's.
And so that should be the next priority.
Absolutely. And I think today gives us that hope that, yes, we're getting nearer that time when we can welcome people back in here. And, you know, with the vaccination rollout now nearly completed for those older people, you know, that looks very hopeful for us. And we can't wait to welcome everyone back.
Siobhan Grant of St. Joseph's Nursing Home. And to chat more about these dividends that we're seeing from the vaccine rollout, Brian heard from Professor Cliannini Chaly, consultant in infectious diseases at St. James's in Dublin.
It's wonderful, and actually my mum attends the day services in St. Joseph's, and they are an absolutely wonderful facility, and I've seen how much she and my dad have missed that, so that was wonderful to hear, and thank you to the staff there. Yeah, it's just fantastic. We're really, you know, seeing that we're not seeing patients being admitted to hospital from nursing homes. We're not seeing our staff getting sick to the same degree that they were, and we can very clearly see the benefit of the vaccines, and it's a great feeling to be able to see that.
Now, of course, today, as we know, the Cabinet will be considering a revised vaccine programme presented to it by the HSE. We know about the restrictions around the use of AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson, but the message from the HSE and from the public health experts is we stick with this age-based system. Are they taking the right course, do you think?
I think they are. I mean, one of the most important things is the speed at which it happens. And it looks now with much greater supply of vaccine coming in a way, you know, if the difference is only a week or two between one group and another, the sequence becomes less important. And we're getting down into age groups in which, you know, a significant proportion of people in those age groups may also have had coexisting conditions because people tend to get sicker as they get older. So we're really picking up those groups now. So, and it's much easier to do things on an age-based basis, as we've seen, because we don't have a unique patient identifier. We don't have the type of national IT to support a registry of disease. So I think the HSE's approach is sensible.
And some flexibility in the application of these vaccines, even though it's preferable, we're told, that the AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson are used in the over 50s. It's also been said that if nothing else is available for people under 50, it'll be administered to them.
Yeah, and I think that is fantastic because we know that the risks of the severe clotting problems with AstraZeneca and Johnson are very, that type of clot is very severe and can be life-threatening, but it occurs very, 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 very rarely. And I think giving people that option to weigh up their own risks and their own preferences and to decide whether they would prefer to go ahead and get AstraZeneca or Johnson & Johnson or to wait and which risk they feel is bigger, I think that's a very sensible thing to do. And indeed myself, you know, if it was a choice between getting AstraZeneca now and waiting, a number of months to get a different type of vaccine, I probably would choose to get AstraZeneca now. So I think enabling that choice, if we have the system and the infrastructure to support that, is an excellent idea.
Professor Cliannini Chaly, consultant in infectious diseases at St. James's Hospital in Dublin, speaking to Brian Dobson on the News at One. And as restrictions continue to lift, we all have our eyes set on summer holidays around the country, provided you can get a booking. Fionn Davenport shared his top spots in Connacht on Today with Claire Byrne. Liveline was flying the flag for lovely Leitrim. And on the Ray D'Arcy show, John Creedon was doing his bit for the Beara Peninsula after tweeting out a picture of his Cork idyll.
The plan wasn't to make you jealous at all, actually, Ray. The plan was just to show just how wonderful a country we live in. And you know something? I know. You're a Kildare man, so landlocked over the last week or two there. But in time, I expect if we all play our cards right, we'll all be moving intercounty and rediscovering this brilliant country of ours. I think last year, really, Ray, what happened was with the staycation, a lot of people who hadn't put their toe back in the water, so to speak, maybe people who went for a weekend to Dingle or went to a stag party in Galway, had never actually taken the time to spend 2 weeks in North Mayo or something like that. And I think, like, in huge numbers, people have come back and said, Jesus, this is a beautiful country. And it is. So I had my 2 weeks off. I had to stay inside the county. Fortunately, as you say, Cork is a pretty big one. It's like the Texas. So I tootled along. Mairead and myself got a camper van and we tootled out west. And I just love the peninsulas. I mean, I love all of Ireland. I love the headlands from Malinhead to Mizzenhead, Helvig Head over in Waterford, Hook Head. Yeah. But all the peninsulas along the west coast, they kind of point defiantly out into the Atlantic. And that's the kind of people you get there as well. They're tough, hardy people who can survive on bad land. And yet there's a romance and a warmth to, you know, Dingle Peninsula, Ivragh, Sheep's Head Peninsula. All those peninsulas are full of their own subcultures, mini cultures. So Oidochus, for me, or my home is, I suppose, my birthplace, my maternal home is the Beara Peninsula. My mother came from Adrigal. So to go out the Beara Peninsula, leaving from Bantry, like it's a feast of place names as well. You
Ballylicky.
Know, you leave Bantry, you go on to Gleongarraf. Ballylicky, yeah, Bailonalicke. And even just right beyond that is a place called Snov. And it is what it says on the tin. They used to swim the cattle across there in the high tide, and that's it earned it the name Snov. And to this day it's spelt in English now, or some form of transliteration, S-N-A-V-E. You go on through Gleongarraf, Glengarriff, Rough Glen.
Beautiful.
And it is, as you come descend into Glengarriff. Oh, stunning. And also I think Beara is blessed, as is our southwest, with just a very warm, mellow kind of climate. There's a microclimate there in Glengarriff, and on Garnish Island, as you probably well know, you can take a little ferry out there, 10 minutes past the seals who are sunbathing on the rocks, and you have these Italianate gardens where plants grow that wouldn't grow elsewhere in Ireland. So there is it borders on a temperate subtropical climate there. Yes, it can be damp, like,
and
the
what
southwest
what
can
about
be,
that
but you
woman,
go on beyond Glengarriff.
What about that woman who said to me years ago,
who
I was doing a disco down in Castletown Bear, and I said, where should I go? And she said to me,
in the Wheel Inn, was it?
Yeah, I was doing the Wheel Inn. Yeah. She said, Have you done that? Yeah. She says, have you done the Ring of Beara?
Professionally and socially, I hasten to add. What? The Ring of Beara?
She said, that's what she said
absolutely.
To me. Have you done the Ring of Beara? And I said, I haven't. She said, forget about the Ring of Kerry. You haven't lived until you've done the Ring of Beara. Yeah.
They're all beautiful. Do you know what now, if you want, I don't know how much time you've got, but I can rattle you around the Ring of Beara very quickly.
Go on.
And again, the place names do jump out as being beautiful. Okay, so we've left Bantry, we've gone through Snov, we've gone through Gleongarraff, the Rough Glen. We move on there, then keep going west all the time to Garavinish. Actually, Garnish is an interesting place name too. Some people think it means rough island, but it isn't rough. So other people think it's gar as in short, so as in close island, near island, because it is. Uh-huh. On through my mother's country, Adrigal, with the beautiful Cahan Mountains, Hungry Hill looming off in the distance. Adrigal gets its name from Adrguil, which means between inlets or between junctions. And if you look down from Mass Mount, it's stunning. It looks to me oriental. You've got those beautiful trees out there, the little islands, and it's a very secure little anchorage there in Adrigal between two inlets, as it is. On to Ross Ficcion. Ross, of course, means a headland, a wooded headland, and that's how it is to this day. When the ancients arrived there, that's how it was. It still is. A lot of the landscape there is untouched. Like, you can see, looking at those mountains, that neither a cow nor a plough has touched that land in millennia. On to Castletown Bear, that tells its own story. Castle, town, Bear. You wouldn't want to be in Egypt to work that one out. You're looking out at Bear Island. Dunboy Castle is just beyond it. Dún Buí, the Yellow Fort, and that was the home of O'Sullivan Bear. And I actually tweeted, dare I say it, a lovely photograph taken there as well, and it looks totally tropical. It's got this beautiful turquoise waters, good fishing spots around Dunboy there as well. Go on out, you pass Dursey. Or before that even, you come to the Dojon Beira. I've gone on a few retreats there. It's the Buddhist retreat centre. And that is stunning. The view, they built a clifftop temple, so to speak, and meditation room. And it's glass from toe to ceiling. So when you stand there in the silence with the smell of the incense and the lotus flowers and everything else, and you just look out that window, you can see seagulls beneath you, circling on the cliffs below you. And you look south, you're looking due south, and your next stop is probably Madeira, or the Antarctic or something. There's just that huge weight of ocean out there. But you move on from there, down the road, there's the turn left. You can get the cable car across to Dursey Island, named by the Vikings. Any island that ends in EY, whether it's Lambay or Ireland's Eye, EY means island in Old Norse. So Dursey actually means Bull Island. So obviously there were cattle there and the Vikings would have raided on the way past. You go on out to Alahees with its gorgeous beach, the copper mines and all the dot, like it's like a cluster of orange, blue, green. The houses there, people purposely paint their colours and really or paint their houses in really loud colours. And it's the same in Iree. So from the sea, you can see this little cluster like of outrageous colours, orange, ochre, purple, maroon, mauve, blue, green, you name it. And Iree, similarly, a beautiful, beautiful little village. And you pass on through there to Kilcathran, one of the most ancient Christian settlements we have on the island, possibly the oldest cross, standing cross there. I actually saw it just last week. I'll tweet a photograph of that too eventually. And some of the figurines out there. There were Catholics, or not Catholics, Christians worshipping there since I think about the 600 or 700s. So shortly after Patrick, there were Christians living there on the rock. The views are stunning. You look west at the sunsets and they're beautiful. You continue on the Beira, the Ring of Beira, and as you come around, you're now facing northwards and you're looking across Kenmare Bay with all its majesty, the Kenmare River, technically, but it is Kenmare Bay. So you're looking into Kerry. You're actually in Kerry, really, because interestingly about the Beira Peninsula, it's within the Kerry Diocese and it's football central. This is the interface between Cork and Kerry football. It's all football in Beira. It's hurling a lot in the city and in East Cork, but down in Beira, it's Gaelic football, and the two counties actually meet on the northern section of the Beira Peninsula. You're technically in County Kerry, and you're in the Kerry Diocese for all of Beira, as I understand.
I mentioned Bunnaw last week, and somebody corrected me saying that was in Kerry and not in Cork.
Well, you know something? I bet you a pound there's one in each.
All right.
Because Bunnaw probably comes from Bun Owen, meaning the end of the river. Wherever you see Bun, like Bun Doran, Bun Crana is the end of the Crana River. It's where it comes into the Atlantic. And the same here in Cork, Crosshaven, Oscoelga is Bun Tharna. It's where a river ends. So, I mean, Beira, it's like all of the peninsulas. But I'm talking to a buddy of mine in Wexford yesterday. And I mean, like, the offerings down there are so rich as well. Yeah. Viking, Norman, castles, Kilkenny is full of it. So the fact that I was in Beira and tweeted, it people keep asking me, what's the nicest place in Ireland? And I keep saying, it's wherever I am now, if my mood is right.
But home is where the heart is. And I know your family.
It is,
your
but my father's people would...
In Chiquila.
Yeah, but my father's people would kill me if I didn't mention Inchigida. But it's like that. Ireland is full of it. The nooks, the crannies. And even, I think, with the 5K lockdown, what surprised a lot of people on their perambulations around their own neighbourhood is, how did that street get called Murphy's Lane? Oh, a fella called Murphy won the lottery there 20 years ago or whatever. And so
can I ask you a question? John, about Iree's and the brightly coloured houses, as you've so vividly described? When I arrived down there first, somebody told me that Cork County Council offered grants for people to paint their houses in brightly coloured paint. Is that true or false?
Well, I don't know, but if they didn't, they should have.
Very good.
They look so welcoming because it is such, there's so much wilderness there. There's so much mountain, ocean, that when you're travelling along, and particularly I'd say if you're on a boat, if you're out fishing, to see that cluster of houses or a little cluster of lights, is a beautiful thing. It's like a calling you to home. So I really felt that now, genuinely, physically, physiologically. When I see those places, it feels like I've seen an old friend that I haven't seen for years. And in this case, it's actually true.
John Creedon on The Ray D'Arcy Show. The Irish Network Against Racism, INAR, has logged record-breaking reports of racist incidents and assaults. And in the first of three special reports on Morning Ireland, social affairs correspondent Alva Keneally explores the issue of racism in Ireland and asks what can be done to tackle it.
Today's conference was told how the ugly monster of racism has taken to our streets.
What's needed here is leadership. Leadership to ensure that attitudes change and that people are welcome, not just tolerated.
This report was broadcast by RTE in the year 2000, but it's a report that is just as relevant today. In the last 21 years, Irish society has changed as a result of immigration, and yet little has been done to tackle the problem of racism. Professor of Migration and Social Policy at UCD, Brian Fanning.
Certainly, I think Irish society is pretty tolerant of immigration. That basically, if you look at the right-wing parties that are trying to become established, they basically attract a very small group of people. That most people, I think, would like to see Ireland as an open and tolerant society. However well-meaning that is, though, our institutions don't look like the wider diversity of our society, such as, say, the civil service, the teachers in our schools, perhaps even the media. Academia could be more representative, I think, of wider society also. So I think there is a sort of an onus in us then to see that those institutions begin to reflect the diversity of our society, just as they also need to reflect diversity around gender and other issues also. I mean, if our institutions don't look like who we are, they're not going to do a great job on our behalf, I think.
That diversity is not evident where the biggest decisions are made, the Oireachtas. Politicians like Senator Eileen Flynn, who's a member of the traveller community, understands the struggle in getting beyond the gates of Leinster House.
Those gates have been shut for so, so long, these gates behind me, and they're opened a little bit now at present, and I'm hoping that they will open up even wider for people from ethnic minority groups and for people who genuinely have an interest in politics, because like black people and traveller people are not just black people and not just travellers, if you know what I mean. We are also people that have an interest in the world, that wants to be doctors, nurses, wants to be solicitors and want to be politicians. And I was very lucky to get the opportunity that I got. Unfortunately, I missed out by a very narrow margin, and I'm still grateful, and I will always be grateful to the Aunt Taoiseach Micheál Martin for nominating me as one of his 11. But also I think it's very important that we acknowledge the work that I've done to get to where I am today, and the work that women in general from ethnic minority groups, and how it's tough for all women, but we never really look at how tough it is for women from ethnic minority groups.
Representation is also important at a local level. Fianna Fáil's Arimu Adetami is a member of Longford County Council.
We are moving into a new modern Ireland where we'll have to, you know, take stock of who is in the country, who are the people, who are we representing, what type of Ireland do we want to see tomorrow, what type of Ireland do we want to hand over to the next generation. There's a lot of mixed race children in Ireland, a lot of children from migrant background, so there's going to be a lot of interrelations. And you know, if we want to see a better Ireland, a more ethical society, we need to start, you know, moving on swiftly from having the conversations to making sustainable changes that will see us into a better Ireland.
Beyond their day jobs, these women face relentless levels of racism through social media.
I try to raise above it, even though it's very hurtful. It is extremely hurtful, and I report it to INAR, ireport.ie, and I do report the discrimination, and I block people, you know, and I will be honest, I do block people, and I won't say what sometimes I write back to people, you know, when they are a little bit, when they are racist to me, because I think I have every right to respond to them as Eileen Flynn, and not even as a public representative, because they're attacking me for being Eileen, you know.
It's called social media. If you're being antisocial, you shouldn't be on social media. So there definitely have to be punitive measures for people that are anything but social. Thankfully, I don't get too much, and fingers crossed, I won't. But I try to maintain a positive profile online because it's so important. If any, there's any negative comments on my page or on my social media, I just hide them because I don't want to see them. I don't want my followers to see them, and I don't want anybody to engage with that.
In the year 2000, the internet was in its infancy and people didn't have their own mobile devices, so this form of racism wasn't an issue. While the government's publication of hate crime legislation has been welcomed, Ireland's Human Rights and Equality Commissioner Sinead Gibney says it's not enough.
There is legislation progressing at the moment to deal with online hate speech, but I do think that Ireland also needs to consider its role as a country which houses platforms here in Ireland. So many of the tech companies are based here in Ireland, and what their role is. And I don't think we are dealing with that yet as a society, and certainly I don't think government are dealing with it. I mean, if internet platforms are profiting through the polarisation of views or the proliferation of hate speech online, we have to look at that.
Human Rights and Equality Commissioner Sinead Gibney ending Alva Keneally's report. And part two of the series can be heard on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. Liveline today hit upon a serious social issue that parents need to tackle, and that is how easily porn can be accessed on smartphones and the impact unfettered access to the internet can have on growing minds. Michelle, not a real name, spoke to Jo about a conversation she had to have with her 9-year-old daughter.
I contacted you because of an issue that I've been quite worried about for a bit of time, and it culminated in an event at breakfast for me last week with my 9-year-old daughter, where she was saying that one of her friends, who's a similar age, was just being gross. And I said, well, what do you mean they were being gross? And she said, well, today's event was where he said he was just quoting porn, basically.
Okay.
It started off a couple of weeks ago where she said, oh, he was making weird noises today. And I was like, oh, what was it? And he mimicked an orgasm. And then last week at breakfast, it was like, well, he's being gross again. And he said, oh, daddy, f*** me harder, daddy. And he starts making more porn noises, you know.
My God.
Yeah.
Where do you think this child is picking up that language?
I just think that, like, it's so many of them now have unsupervised access to phones, you know. And it's natural for kids to be curious. Like, I'm very much liberal about all things sexual, really, but it's gotten to the point where, you know, basically, as far as I'm aware, like...
Does this child have a smartphone?
Yeah, he does seem to have access to one, yeah.
Okay, because if it is a smartphone, it's very worrying. If he's picking up the language somewhere else, it's extraordinarily worrying. So you think it is a smartphone, not something even more serious?
Oh, I absolutely do. Okay. 100%. Okay. Yeah, I really think that, yeah.
So what can be done?
Well, I just think there's so much about it. Like, there's that. I was just so shocked having to have that conversation with my daughter. You know, she's 9, at the breakfast table. And I had to talk her through it a little bit and not be too extreme, you know, because I don't want her to be too alarmed. But there was other stuff. And, you know, you see kids using phones unsupervised all the time. The kids are, like, you know, doing really adult dances into phones. I've seen, like, local 8-year-olds around our area doing that. And, you know, I just really feel there's a big problem with kids viewing online porn, you know.
And when you say provocative, that you mean twerking and all that
stuff,
which is adult behaviour, but shouldn't be children's behaviour.
Not at all. And, like, those sites, like, people don't realise about TikTok and stuff. Like, if you flick through those sites, you'd have anything from sexual innuendo on the videos to people talking about depression and killing themselves, you know. And the kids are on TikTok. Like, now, in fairness, the companies make an effort. They say, look, minimum age 13. But I really feel like we leave kids, we make them wait till they're 18 to get a licence to drive. Why they should be unsupervised watching porn from the age of 9 and 10 is just beyond me, you know. And it's happening.
And what a minimum age for access to smartphones.
Would
it make a difference, Michelle?
I really feel that that is a solution. And I know that the government don't want to be feeling like a nanny state, but I think there is huge support among parents. Like, I think they want help. You know, they're always under pressure with, oh, well, you're ruining my life because everyone else has one. And it's all this business. And like, there's no problem with smartphones per se, but the amount of adult content being accessed is just really crazy, you know. And I have another friend whose best friend is a professional in the medical professional.
Yeah.
And she says that 15-year-olds are presenting to A&E with anal tearing. 15-year-old girls. You know, because the lads want to do what they're seeing on the phones, and they're like, let's do this. And they're going into it without any proper knowledge or education on it, you know.
Okay.
And I've had friends who've, you know, like, you see the guys feel under pressure to do what's on the, what they're seeing on the screens, even though they might not want to, but they feel like they won't be a proper guy if they don't, because they don't realise that porn isn't real. I think we need to be talking to kids about it, because they're watching.
Would you be tempted to contact that child's parents?
I'm going to have a very gentle, kind conversation about it, because I really, really feel very, very sure. I feel very confident that they're totally unaware. And I'm going to say, look, there's probably a bit of watching going on. And at the moment, what's happening for that child is that they're just going to socially isolate themselves from their friends a little bit. Their friends are going to think they're a bit gross. That's what was described to me. But it's, I feel really disappointed that I've had to have that conversation with my 9-year-old, you know. Yeah.
Can two final questions. One, has the pandemic made a difference where a lot of children are on their own in their rooms longer?
I don't think so, because they had access to those phones before the pandemic. It may have made it slightly exacerbated. I don't think that has made it. It's been a problem for a while. I remember seeing an article on the paper a long while back by a judge who said he's got people coming in to the court committing sexual offences at the age of 12 and 13, and he actually said on the headline, it's starting with porn on their phones. And solicitors increasingly, he said, are coming in asking for porn to be considered a mitigating circumstance for 12, 13 and 14-year-old children committing sexual crimes, you know, attacking people. Like. And I don't think we suddenly have sort of manifested an epidemic of children who grow up sexually attacking each other. I think porn is causing it. I think it's a really serious social problem. And, you know, I feel very, like, scared bringing my child up in this situation. And for me as a mother of a girl, it's a big thing, but mothers of boys, like, you know, it's just as scary, because they can get the knock on the door, sorry, your son has attacked someone, and he didn't realise he was doing it because he's only doing what he sees on the phone.
And finally, Michelle, have schools any role in helping?
There's an actual programme that all the schools do called Stay Safe, and I think that discussions around porn, and if not being real at least, need to be added to that. I think it's vital, but before that would happen, I really feel that the government could help us by stepping in and putting, like, really stricter rules in place in terms of who can get a smartphone. Children might need contact, but they don't need to have access to the internet, you know?
Yeah.
Till 14, 16 or whatever age, but like, 9-year-olds having unlimited access to Google and YouTube is extreme to me.
Joe and Michelle, hopefully prompting some important conversations, as heard on Liveline. The usually media-shy Bill and Melinda Gates are global front-page news today, as the Silicon Valley super couple have called it quits on 27 years of marriage. On Morning Ireland, Mary Wilson asked journalist Steve Futterman if this was a surprise.
I would say it is. I was trying to look back on any documentation or any reports hinting of discourse in the marriage, and I have not seen anything suggesting that they were having marital problems or the marriage was on the brink of collapsing. So I think this did catch pretty much everyone by surprise when the Twitter announcements came on both their verified Twitter sites, a similar identical message saying that the marriage was over.
And what did they say in those Twitter announcements?
Well, it was a carefully worded statement. The key line is, after a great deal of thought and a lot of work on our relationship, we have made the decision to end our marriage. They talk about how their work will continue. This is a quote in the statement. We no longer believe we can grow together as a couple in this next phase of our lives. So divorce papers have been filed. They were filed on Monday. It's very likely, almost certainly, that this is a pre-arranged dissolution of the marriage, that the two sides have almost certainly come to an agreement on the division of the assets. Can't be certain on that, but that's usually the case in a situation like this.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about the division of the assets in a moment, but tell us something about, really, until now, this golden couple and the lives that they built together.
Well, they met at a Microsoft business dinner in New York in 1987. Melinda Gates had just recently been hired by Microsoft. She sat next to Bill Gates. He asked her, suggested that they might want to get together. She joked later on it took him a number of months to finally move on and say, yeah, let's go out. And obviously, things developed from there. They were married. And in 1994, the same year that Bill Gates became, at that time, the richest man in the world, and the marriage seemed to flourish. They have three children. Obviously, financially, their finances flourished. Bill Gates now worth, around $130, $140 billion, depending on what site you look at. Also, what I think really has touched people is their decision to basically give that money eventually away. They've developed the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has so far, I think, dished out around $30 billion in such things as global health, fights against poverty, lots of global efforts that they're very much involved in.
And what about those other assets and the division of those assets? You mentioned a figure, Steve, of something like $130 billion.
Sometimes we see in situations like this, one side wanting a fairer share than the other side is offering. My guess is you will not have that here. My suspicion is, and this is not just my suspicion, but the suspicion of many people, is that the lawyers have been involved in this for a while now. The division of the funds has already been probably agreed to.
Tight control over this announcement. They say, as you told us, that they can no longer grow together. Is there any sign of how they might grow now in different directions or what they plan for the future?
No idea really right now. I think some of this may begin to leak out in the next few days or so. Is there another relationship one of them is having? Has there been some discord, a quiet discord that maybe friends knew about that they may talk about now? That may come out in the next 24 or 48 hours. But at this moment, nothing like that has emerged. It can simply be two people just growing apart. We've seen that happen before as well.
But divorce, as we know well, can also be very acrimonious. Jenny Darmody of Silicon Republic looked at another high-profile breakup when she was chatting to Claire Byrne.
It's the second high-profile divorce we've seen in the super-rich tech arena in recent years. And I'm referring, of course, to the Amazon boss Jeff Bezos' separation from his wife, Mackenzie Scott. Their divorce resulted in her becoming the world's fourth richest woman. Is a similar settlement, would you say, on the cards for Melinda Gates?
It's definitely hard to say how much money Melinda Gates is going to get, but the difference, I suppose, there is the Jeff Bezos divorce. Mackenzie Scott was much more explosive, much more one-sided, I would say, which is how she walked away with, I think it was about $38 billion she walked away with. Now, she has promised to give it all away to charity, but this seems to be a much more amicable. They've done it together. They've come out with joint statements. It didn't fall out the same way. So I don't think the same. I think there was not a grab for money, but like more of a going after of Jeff Bezos, whereas this seems very amicable. She might get a very, very sizable fund, but it will definitely have been agreed upon between the two of them.
All right, Jenny, thank you very much. Jenny Darmody there from Silicon Republic. And let's take a further look at the legal side of all of this. I'm joined on the line by Deirdre Burke, who's partner and head of family law at Orpen Frank Solicitors. Good morning, Deirdre.
Good morning, Claire.
Going on what you would see happening in an Irish legal setting, what do you believe is likely to happen in this divorce settlement between Bill and Melinda Gates?
I think what's interesting, well, I think this is interesting for a number of reasons, but the first one would be the fact that it does appear, as your previous interviewer said, that it is going to be an amicable settlement. And I think I'd slightly disagree in relation to comparing the two divorces, the Bezos divorce and this divorce, from the point of view of high conflict yielding more, because very often an amicable settlement can actually, in my experience, yield more. And I think there's another interesting comparison between the two divorces in that Mackenzie Scott actually helped set up Amazon, whereas in this situation, Melinda actually came along to the relationship after Microsoft was established. Now, Mackenzie went away, I think, with about a quarter of the net worth that was there in the Bezos divorce. So I think it will be really interesting if we actually get to find out at all what the settlement is that Melinda gets here. So I actually think the fact that it's amicable and they're approaching this with some level of maturity might actually yield better results for Melinda.
Okay. Yeah, and we're all assuming it's amicable, aren't we? But, I mean, don't forget what kind of PR teams these people will have.
Absolutely. The only thing that would lead me to think that it's likely to be amicable is the fact that if they are going to continue to work together in the foundation, that's unusual. And I would often, even in the most amicable of divorces, advise people that you are better to go for that clean break where you actually disengage completely and you don't continue to work together, where I would work with people who have companies and both are involved. Very often we try to see them set up independently afterwards. But if you're going to work together, you have to have a really, really good relationship and you have to continue that working relationship as you go mm-hmm. forward. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in actual fact. Do they continue to work together with that foundation?
Have you ever seen it work where couples who divorce or separate continue to work together successfully?
Yes, I have. But as I say, it's a rarity and it does require a massive level of communication skills and really still having that good civil working together relationship. Now, these, remember, they have children. Now, they're from 18 to 25. They have three children, 25, 21 and 18 are their ages. So whilst they're technically adults, I'd imagine that the younger two are probably still in college. They've still got a bit of work to do to communicate with raising them and getting them through college. So when you factor children into a divorce as well, you always have to have ongoing communication, and the more civil you can make that, the better.
Okay, and you said there when you mentioned the Jeff Bezos example that his ex-wife got a quarter of his fortune. So this, because Melinda came along after Microsoft was set up, she's likely to get less than a quarter, are you saying?
That's a factor that would be a negative on her side in relation to it. But they live in Washington State, and Washington State works a community property family law division, which means that assets acquired during the marriage are considered communal, and they're usually split equally. So the interesting fact for Melinda is that the bulk of the wealth was generated before the marriage, but yet, as I understand it, most of the wealth has now moved from Microsoft into the foundation, which she set up with him and which she's involved in. So that shifts it again a little bit back towards her. So it's really interesting to watch how this plays out.
And also, Deirdre, the length of the marriage, you know, 27 years.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would have dealt with divorces where people would have been married perhaps only 6 months, all the way up to 40 years. And the length of your marriage is a really important factor when you're looking at how to divide assets on divorce. The longer the marriage, the more you've been involved, the more equal the division is likely to be. But one thing we always have to remember is that equitable division doesn't always mean equal. So when people go in looking for equality, it's not always what comes out. The court has to be satisfied that what has happened is actually proper financial provision, and that doesn't always mean equal.
So what does equitable mean then in that context?
What means with equitable means fair, and it means fair taking into account a huge range of factors. And this would be principles that the Washington courts also apply. So they would look at, for example, is there a prenup? What have the couple decided? What did each party do to contribute to the relationship? What are their ages? What is their health like? What is the situation with regard to children? And what, at the end of the day, does one person need for their financial security and security of accommodation as you go forward? So all of those factors have to be balanced in to ensure that people are provided for. And that, I suppose, that the level of that provision is dependent upon the wealth that is to be divided.
Okay.
But it doesn't always mean 50-50.
I think some people were surprised last night at this news because they seemed like a couple that was so in tune together. And we played the clip from the Netflix series. Also, after 27 years, you'd wonder, you know, why come to this conclusion now? But are you seeing more people later in life who are deciding to go their separate ways?
Absolutely. And there's been what some people refer to as the grey trend in divorces, where we have a lot of, I would have dealt with a lot of people in their 60s, 70s. I think the oldest client I dealt with was possibly 86 when we dealt with a divorce. And people just realise that I suppose whatever number of years you have left are there to be spent in the best way possible. And sometimes that means separate to the person you've spent the past years with. So yes, all ages definitely, and certainly a more openness in the older generations now for to consider divorce.
Oh God, I'm still thinking about the person who was 86 coming to you to seek a divorce. So you go through that long process at 86 years of age to reach a point where you have your final years, as you say, living them in the way that you want to.
Absolutely. And they both in that case came to it with, like this couple, apparently, whether it's PR or reality, they both came to it with a sense of maturity. This is what we both want to do to make the rest of our lives as the best that they can be. And there's that mutual respect that is there when people come to that situation as well. And not always, because obviously you've got the mad conflict situations as well. But if you can bring that respect and maturity to it, it can work out beautifully for both people.
Are most divorces that you deal with acrimonious, or are they calm, or do they start acrimonious and end calm? How would you characterise them in the main?
I would say that unfortunately most are conflicted, and I would say that also the impact of COVID over the last 18 months, whatever length of time we've been like this, has led to more conflict. I would unfortunately see more conflict involving children. I'd say I'd probably split my files, Claire, two-thirds, one-third, where maybe one-third are amicable. But I think that what I would say, I suppose, as a saver to that, is that most cases ultimately settle. No matter how conflicted they start out at, most people ultimately agree things. But the key to an amicable resolution, I think, is front-load the information. Get your information as soon as possible, understand the consequences and what's at stake, and then it more likely you will realise there's a cost saving, there's an emotional saving in relation to moving things forward amicably.
Deirdre Burke, partner and head of family law at Orpen Frank Solicitors, on Today with Claire Byrne. Well, another summer is set to pass without a single teen Kaylee dancing to Robert Miles's Children. And without Irish colleges and such like, and the Erasmus programme harder to access due to the pandemic, many people are turning to learning a language online. But how does this kind of learning differ from total immersion? Professor of Sociolinguistics at UCD, Vera Regan, weighed in.
A lot of us were deprived of access to the country, going to the country, and our students, a lot of them had quite a lot of difficulties getting to their country of destination. Now, they did a really good job. We taught language in universities at home in classrooms, and we run virtual classrooms. But by and large, the news is that it really is important to go to the country, and it has huge benefits. Going to the country has benefits for the individual, it has benefits for society, and it benefits for our economy. And for the individual, what we find is that there are a lot of cognitive benefits. People who learn languages have a lot of gifts and talents that are not just about language learning, but their brains are actually different and they function better, so they can learn other things better as well. They're very flexible, and it means that when then they need to be flexible about all the new things we need to learn, like while we were locked down in COVID, we need to suddenly be very agile. Well, these are people with super flexibility because of their bilingual or their multilingual brain. So it's really important for the individual as an individual, and so they're going to get better jobs quite practically because they'll be able to adapt. It's also good in terms of our general society because it means people have access to jobs and skills and resources that they wouldn't have had before, where it might have been a small elite of people who went abroad before, whereas now the government, the EU and the universities are supporting these. And then we need to be thinking of our new economy. With the Brexit now, we need to be very attentive to the European markets rather than simply access, because we have less easy access to the British market.
And
so it's really important for us.
And Joe McHugh, you know all about this because people will remember that you learned a language very much in the public eye in 2014 when Taoiseach Enda Kenny at the time made you minister with responsibility for Gaeltacht affairs. And you took the view and made the decision that you would go to the Gaeltacht to learn. Could you see the advantages of that at the time? What informed your decision?
suppose there was a right bit of pressure at the time, Claire, and I was, as you said, it was in the public eye. But one of the decisions that I had to make very quickly was that I would have to learn Irish in the public eye, and what that meant, getting rid of the shackles and fears around making mistakes and making grammar mistakes. And I remember having a car crash interview on Tidhg Cathair at the very early stages. But in order to learn a language, you have to put yourself out there. And I suppose a 2, 3, and 4-year-old child doesn't have those reservations, and it's a big part of the problem for a lot of people going back to learn a language, or having maybe the trepidation of thinking back to their own experiences in primary or secondary school. So in order for me to maximise my journey time in a very short period of time, I was very fortunate. Becoming minister, you get access to a driver week on, week off. So Joe and John were fluent Irish speakers, so we had full immersion in the car. I'm very fortunate where I live. So I'm just right on the border of the Gaeltacht in the parish of Meva. And obviously then the high profile attendance at Glencolum College of Scale, that which Enda Kenny suggested at the time. At the time I thought I was given a hospital pass, but in hindsight now, 6 years later, it was a gift and I'm grateful.
Were you nervous about speaking Irish in the Gaeltacht when you didn't have the fluency?
Glencolum Kill is unique because it wouldn't be a very, very strong Gaeltacht area compared to Cador. And I was allowed that freedom and, I suppose, flexibility to do the bilingual, the English and the Irish. But I also had a perception of strong Gaeltacht areas like Cador that people were measuring you and people were evaluating your standard of Irish. But that was dismissed straight away because the native Irish speaker, whether they're in Connemara or in West Donegal, they want you to do well. They encourage, and I just tapped into that enthusiasm and encouragement. And like the native Irish speaker as well, like they don't spend time wasting time struggling if a word doesn't fit or there's a new terminology like Lehan Wanda that we use for broadband. The native Irish speaker will use broadband or use an English word, so they don't have that hang up mm-hmm. that maybe that there's a perceived perception around that.
Because you know, and I'll get Vera's view on this as well. A lot of people have been using apps to try and learn a new language, but do you see the advantage of speaking it out loud as opposed to sitting there with your phone and working through lessons in script?
Look, I think the ideal scenario is to have the company and presence of somebody, you know, who speaks, you know, and whether that's in a, you know, in a Gaeltacht area or outside of a Gaeltacht area. But one of the things that you learn very quickly when you go back learning Irish is all around us, and it's not just the reservation of the Gaeltacht areas. And what surprised me so much was the amount of people, whether they were in Lifford or in Dublin or, you know, different parts of the country, who knew that I was on my learning journey, the people that would even attempt a little bit of Irish. So the key thing is, yes, combination of everything, apps, Duolingo. There's so many supports in relation to online resources as well, Faulkner.ie, Changlin.ie, Charma.ie. There's no shortage of supports, but the real beauty in learning any language is you have to immerse yourself with the people, and there is a Shanachal, Mahat, if you want to get to know us, live with us.
Yeah, Vera, well, first of all, I'm struck as you speak in your lovely Irish there, Joe, that I don't understand that Irish. It's completely different to the Irish that I would know and have used and learned.
Well look, I think people talk about the different dialects. Look, there's different dialects in this country, and I don't want to single out any politicians in particular, but if you take a number of the independent TDs in Tipperary and Kerry, sometimes I struggle with their English. Sometimes I find they talk too fast. And when you go on to the heart of a Gaeltacht area, they talk, 100 miles an hour to each other. They're used to it. And that can be a difficulty. But look, I think what we need to do with any language is it has to be done in incremental steps. And one of the things and one of the most important things we have to do in the primary and secondary school sector is to ensure that it is done in a creative and fun way. A lot of teachers are doing that, but there's one project that I would like to see implemented, and that is PE through Irish. We have a pilot up and running, and I will be impressing upon this government to ensure that we roll that out nationally to all the medium schools, medium English speaking schools.
Vera, I really want to ask you about the apps, because I know even amongst ourselves here in the office that a lot of us are trying to use the apps to sort of improve our language skills. Do you think they're worthwhile?
I think they're great, Claire, and I think they're great as a tool to add to your language learning. First of all, I think what Joe was saying there was really interesting. First of all, he was talking about how he felt about it. And when we feel bad about ourselves, we're inclined to screen out anything. So we put up what's called the affective filter. And if somebody is feeling bad, then if you've got your affective filter, the language won't go in. And what he did was he related to the people and he was focused on doing stuff. So there were two things happening there. Number one, he wasn't monitoring himself and criticizing himself or thinking about people being critical. So the language was going in. Second of all, he was focusing on doing things with the language. So he wasn't focusing on the language, right? He was focusing on getting stuff done. And that's what we find really works well. So that, say, kids who go to abroad or kids who go to the Gaeltacht, they may be doing sailing or windsurfing or whatever. So they're not monitoring, they're relaxed, they're learning, the language is going in, they're not being critical. And I think that the interaction with people is what's really most important. So yeah, the apps are good, but for instance, you won't really get that detailed knowledge of how to live in a community from an app. From an app, you may get like two answers and you choose one. That's great. But it doesn't get you that subtlety. The things about how to be formal, informal, how to relate to people. Supposing you're sitting at a meeting with EU members and you're chatting to them before the meeting, you're making a bonding situation there, which can be really important if you're doing a deal with them afterwards. And if you know how to go from being formal and informal and using relaxed language and then switch to your formal. So that's really important. That's the sort of stuff you won't get out of an app. So I think the apps are great. They'll tell you a certain amount. You can learn vocabulary. But what you don't learn is stuff like choosing the right word in the right situation for the right person, being funny, being poetic, being relaxed with another person. So apps great, but not enough. You need to go.
So you need to go and you need to speak the language out loud. And Joe, you learned that, Joe, didn't you, from your time learning Irish, that saying it out loud, even if you're on your own, is really important.
It is, and look, we spend a lot of time on our own, whether it's having a shower, whether it's jogging, or even those moments which maybe some of us struggle at night time, going to sleep at night. I trained myself, and it was a great bit of advice, I trained myself to think as Gaelica. So because I probably had limited vocabulary, I ended up getting to sleep quicker because I didn't have as much negative thoughts as Berla. But you have to do that, and you have to make a conscious decision that you go where every opportunity arises.
Fine Gael, TD for Donegal and former Education Minister and Minister for the Gaeltacht, Joe McHugh, and Professor of Sociolinguistics at UCD, Vera Regan, on Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily for today, Tuesday the 4th of May. I'm Gemma Craddock and thank you for listening.